York City is constantly evolving, both above ground and underground.
The idea of the low line is that we can use this sort of next generation advanced solar technology to irrigate natural sunlight down into that space, and in doing so, grow plants and turn it into a vibrant public space.
I'm George Bodarkey, and this is Cityscape. Coming up, we'll hear more about efforts to construct what's billed as the world's first underground park and an abandoned trolley terminal on Manhattan's Lower East Side, as well as other efforts to reinvent underutilized spaces in the Big Apple. But first, we start with a little bit of history, or rather, mystery. Possible existence of cow tunnels in New York City. Yes, cows, as in... After reading Betsy Fussell's book called Raising Stakes, which mentions the cow tunnels, Nikki Twilley began her search to find out whether the cow tunnels actually existed. Twilley is author of the blog Edible Geography and a host of the Gastropod podcast. She's on the phone with us now. Nikki, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
It's a pleasure.
So, cow tunnels in New York City, a thing or not?
Yes. Well, for a long time, I thought not a thing. And now I think maybe a thing, but something that no one has seen in decades. So you've just got to believe at this point.
So let's take this from the beginning. How did you even get interested in exploring this idea of cow tunnels in New York City?
I was reading a great book about the history of meat in America called Raising Stakes. It's all about beef and how Americans relate to beef. And there was just a little aside in there that mentioned, oh, well, when the railways were invented, there started to be a huge influx of live cattle to Manhattan where the cows are being slaughtered. And it was causing a cow jam on 12th Avenue. And so the railway companies who'd been shipping in these cows decided to build a tunnel underneath 12th Avenue to sort of ease the cow jam. And it was just a little aside in there, and I thought, that's crazy. A cow tunnel. I wonder if it still exists. And that led me on a multi-year quest.
So what did you find out about the cow tunnel?
Well, so first of all, there are more fictional cow tunnels than there ever were real ones. I tracked down a former utilities engineer turned mystery writer called Brian Wiprud, who had written an article about these so-called rumored cow tunnels in 1997. And he had first heard about them from a Con Ed inspector called Just Fred.
Just
no
Fred.
Last name given. Just Fred. And there were all sorts. People said they were underneath 12th or 34th. People said they were at 39th or 38th. Some people said they were actually in the West Village. Some people said they were down near the entrance to the Holland Tunnel. Some people said they were brick-lined. Some people said they were wood-lined. So there was no definitive proof. And I consulted the fire industry insurance maps. Sanborn maps are usually the definitive maps. No cow tunnel on there. So I was beginning to think...
Urban myth?
That it was... Yeah, exactly. I called a bunch of historic preservationists. They all said, no, sorry, never heard of it, never seen it, nothing. I was beginning to give up hope, and then I called a woman called C.C. Saunders.
She has a last name.
Not just Fred. She's an archaeological, runs an archaeological consulting firm called Historical Perspectives, and she does a bunch of consulting for the city often when, you know, they're digging up the Hudson Yards renewal project. They'll do an archaeological study, see if there's anything they need to preserve or examine first before it gets damaged. She had done a whole study when the city was doing some reconstruction on the West Side Highway, and I called her. I got her. She was on the Staten Island Ferry just coming back from a dig, and she said, oh, yeah, of course. I've got the blueprint. Of course there's a cow tunnel.
Wow.
Then I sat there and drummed my fingers while she got back to the office, and she emailed me the blueprint and the original permit. And it turns out that the actual cow tunnel was built much later than I thought. It was built in 1932. So I had thought it was from the 1870s. And that's actually what, in that Raising Stakes book, that's what the author there said. So
from the 1870s.
From the 1870s, exactly. But actually it was built in 1932. That's when the permit was issued. It has a gentle slope down and then up the other side. You can see it really clearly on the map. It's labeled as a cow tunnel, and it is at West 38th and 12th. And so I said, well, is it still down there?
And
no one knows.
No one knows.
No one knows.
Does anyone care to find out besides you?
Right. I need to go and knock on everyone's doors who owns the buildings around there and say, hey, by the way, do you have an entrance to a cow tunnel in your basement? I haven't gone that far yet. I'm only a few steps away from completely crazy, but I'm not there.
You would think historic preservationists would really want to find this out and landmark it.
Oh, there's actually been a report recommending these cow tunnels to be historic landmarks. The Preservation Committee has recommended that if they still exist, they should be historic landmarks because they're really one of the few unique examples of urban livestock infrastructure left in the city. I mean, the whole meatpacking district now is just bars and, you know, fancy clothing and restaurants and whatnot. This is something that reminds us of an era before refrigeration when if we wanted beef, it had to come here alive and be killed here in Manhattan.
Right. This really tells a story about New York City and our food.
Exactly. I mean, that's how you had beef in those days. It's almost amazing to imagine. I mean, 1932, there was refrigeration at that point, but still the city is slaughtering that many live animals that it makes sense to build a cow tunnel. These cows were brought in on the railway from the Midwest, sort of put in giant cow parking lots in New Jersey, floated across the river on barges, and then led through this tunnel to the slaughterhouses.
1932, no images to actually document this out there that you've found?
Just the blueprints.
Just the blueprints, no photos.
There is an engraving that was done for Harper's Magazine that shows a cow coming out of a tunnel. No one is quite sure of the authenticity of that. It's a sketch. No one knows. But that's it. No photographs, nothing that I've found. Again, I mean, the quest continues.
And I guess there's a possibility that there could be more than one tunnel, right? You have an answer to the fact that there is one, but there could be more?
Oh, completely. I mean, I think the fact that one exists and that it was built that late, to me, that seems to imply that there were more before. Perhaps they fell into disrepair. I don't know.
That's pretty fantastic. An amazing piece of New York City food history and history in general.
Thank you. Yes, it's fun. I would love, if anyone knows any more, I would love to hear it.
Nikki, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Nikki Twilley. She's author of the blog Edible Geography and a host of the GastroPod podcast. You can learn more about her work at ediblegeography.com. The story of the cow tunnels takes us to an area of New York City now widely known for the High Line, the popular park on an old elevated railway. Well, now the Design Trust for Public Space is working with city officials to reclaim and transform spaces under elevated transit infrastructure. Joining us now on Cityscape is Susan Chin. She's the executive director of the Design Trust for Public Space. Susan, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks, George.
So first of all, give us a little bit of background on the organization.
The Design Trust was started 20 years ago to, how do I say, catalyze, reimagine public space. And no one at that time was thinking about public space. You think 20 years is not a long time. So we bring together city agencies, community organizations, and private sector experts, architects, landscape architects, urban designers, graphic designers, artists, to problem seek as well as problem solve. So if you had public space on the campus that you were going to reimagine and catalyze new thinking about, you would come to us and we'd hold a jury, and the jury might select your project, and then we'd select fellows who are the private sector experts to move forward in the exploration of your project.
The Design Trust for Public Space was instrumental in seeing the High Line, New York City's very, very, very popular elevated park, to fruition, correct?
Indeed. That was in 1999-2000. It was transformative work. I mean, who would ever think of a derelict elevated rail line that had been abandoned, I think, since the 80s? We crafted a feasibility study that helped to convince, I think it started it under the Giuliani administration, and then convinced the Bloomberg administration to save the structure. And then Josh David and Robbie Hammond created Friends of the High Line and took it forward with the Parks Department and all those other private partners to create this amazing resource for the city.
Now you have your sights set on underneath spaces, right? Spaces that are underneath elevated infrastructure.
Right. In our High Line study, we had also said that the ground plane underneath was just as important, if not more important, George, than the upper deck. And so I'm very excited. I think we've seen tremendous possibilities for what is almost 700 miles of this kind of elevated infrastructure. So transit infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, and it's bridges, highways, subway lines, rail, and mostly in Upper Manhattan and in the boroughs. So, you know, much of this has been neglected and divides communities. So we're looking for solutions with our project partner, the Department of New York City Department of Transportation, and working to really reimagine. There are endless possibilities.
We're talking about nearly 100 million square feet, right, of underutilized Correct. Space. Nearly four times the size of Central Park.
Right. So in a city that's growing, like New York City, how can we afford to waste space? And so there's really great opportunities with communities to just use our imaginations. Once you've solved the problems of, you know, they're all dark, noisy, really noisy, trash strewn or dirty, parking for days. And then once you've solved some of those problems, I think that you can go on to having really creative programming and other solutions. So you've got those kind of informal uses like skate parks. You know, the adolescents are always much more adventurous and creative in a way that we are not always as appreciative of. And then, you know, looking at in other informal uses, as we found salsa dancing, our photo urbanism fellow found salsa dancing, hip hop competitions. So really, how do you change some of those informal uses into really creative and dynamic spaces, right?
So you had a photojournalist go out and capture the goings on underneath the city's elevated bridges, highways, subway, and rail lines, huh?
She looked at the JMZ line under the Manhattan Bridge, really went out into the neighborhoods and talked with people and actually got them to invite her in to their into their apartments to see what life was about. And so we codified her work in a publication called Life Along the Elevated. So there's so much activity where people are creatively using these spaces because it's sheltered and it may be noisy, but they're really places for people to gather. So, hey, I think there are plenty of them here in the Bronx.
Sure are. This was a 2-year study that you did with the New York City Department of Transportation. What sites specifically did you look at? There were 7 altogether, am I right?
All right. So these nearly 700 miles, you need to break it down into something that's digestible. And so what we did was look at 7 distinct typologies. So landings, trestle under, you know, under the subway that you see the dappled light. We identified with these typologies 7 sites. And so looking at under the Manhattan Bridge in Chinatown in Manhattan, at the Van Wyck, a clover leaf, Van Wyck Expressway, is it Van Wyck or Van Wyck, George? And then on either side of the Queensboro Bridge, we looked at span, the type of spanning, and could you use it for electrical vehicle? And I think we were targeting taxis. Could you charge electric vehicles there? And there's a broad plaza and or create a comfort station for some of the taxi drivers and rest stop. It was really pretty amazing. I'm sorry.
So a wide variety of ideas that came out of that for these spaces.
Indeed. Or, you know, some of these spaces are also real underside, underneath, is really majestic. So in the case of Highbridge Park, we looked at an archway that of the Washington Street Bridge and said, hey, could there be active recreation uses here? Or it had this wonderful, as a radio host, it had this wonderful acoustic quality. So could you have music and singing or some other kind of dancing? So there were really such amazing opportunities that we found looking at these seven different typologies and saying to the Department of Transportation, hey, there are also the multi-jurisdictional challenges. So with highways, for example, they're under the jurisdiction. The upper portion is under the jurisdiction of the New York State Department of Transportation. So working with the city Department of Transportation, could we work together on these structures to improve these spaces?
What about involving the private sector as well? I would imagine that can be a big part of this equation.
Oh, that you've totally hit the nail on the head. Having those community links is really an essential piece of creating a whole sustainable environment. So within the South Bronx, under the 2-5 subway line, with the Women's Housing Economic Development Corp, they had just started, this was last year, we had created what we called the Boogie Down Booth. And they had just started up their Bronx Music Heritage Center program. So it was a brightly colored seat that wrapped a subway pole column and at the Freeman Street stop. And it had a sheltered canopy with solar-powered lighting, independent lighting, so we didn't have to plug into anything in the MTA. And it also had a directional speaker where you could hear music from the Bronx. And so an authentic experience, a directional speaker, sit there and listen to the music. Having that community partner was really a fabulous experiment for us and the DOT. Who maintained it? Who helped spark the idea? They've created a second Boogie Down Booth with the Parks Department and a school nearby. You know, yeah, having that kind of community partnership and with the Southern Boulevard Merchants Association was all about what it was to have a vital neighborhood.
Now, there is also opportunity in reclaiming these underutilized spaces to improve the environment, right? To use plant life to prevent stormwater runoff, correct?
Indeed. We're paying a lot for, what is it called? Combined sewer overflow. And so how to keep our waterways clean? There's millions of gallons of water that pour off of these elevated structures. So how do we capture some of this water, hold it, retain it, either, you know, use it in a bioswale that has plants that both clean the water and also clean the air, so that you have a healthy environment around these elevated infrastructures as well. And some of it will be retained and then slowly released into the sewer system. But then others, I think there's an opportunity for us to also recharge the water table. So you think of the paved areas as really kind of a desert.
Are there notable examples of spaces beneath elevated infrastructure elsewhere in the country that can serve as inspiration?
Well, you know, in Toronto, they've been doing some inspirational work. There's lighting and parks and those things we look to for inspiration. We also looked at, in Tokyo, they created studios, artist studios, so creating a smaller structure, lower structure under a higher elevated. So yeah, there's an inspiration. And then in Chicago, they just launched their Wabash lights. I believe there's a Kickstarter where the lights you can control. You could go there and control the color of the lights with your phone or smartphone or some electronic device. And so it's captured people's imaginations about how you can increase the lighting levels and increase the safety and also have a colorful environment as well.
For many years, you served as an assistant for capital projects in the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs, and you helped to usher in a wide range of projects, like the new museum on the Bowery and the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens. In fact, The Observer once said this about you: Chin helps make New York look like New York and anticipates how it will look 50 or 100 years from now. Now, that's quite the compliment.
Well, that's very sweet of you, George. I'm feeling a bit modest. It was such a privilege to have worked on so many cultural institutions to help them transform their mission and bring, for example, real science to real people in real time. And so helping improve our city is really, I think, part of the Design Trust Corps mission and, I guess, Susan Chin's.
So when you look at New York City, or try to look at New York City, even 10 years from now, you know, the Observer talking about 50 to 100 years from now, but what do you think the city, how do you think the city will evolve?
I envision a way better city. Hey, George, I came here in the mid-70s after the fiscal crisis.
From where?
From Ohio.
Okay.
And I grew up outside of Boston. So to see the transformation of our city and how vital some of these neighborhoods are, there's so many people on the streets. It's so exciting. And to see how people use the city in informal ways, you could never imagine. It's just so great. I mean, even how children use the city to play, right? And so I just can imagine that we'll continue to draw, what was it that was the target by 2030 was originally 1 million new New Yorkers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're now it's 2040, but I think we'll still continue to draw new immigrants, new people from all over the country as well as the globe. Public space is really the lifeblood, the heart of our city. It's where we come together, come to meet each other. I think about the 19th century and Olmsted created Central Park, where the different classes would rub shoulders or meet each other. Well, I think now we look to our streets and our public spaces, our open space, as that kind of catalyzing effect. And the diversity of our city is really what makes it dynamic.
I think you alluded to this before, but when the city's elevated bridges, highways, subway, and rail lines were built, they tore through neighborhoods as the city was growing. And the city is still growing, but now it's all about reclamation. Let's take these places back.
Right.
Let's do something with it.
Hey, George, you and me.
Susan, I'm in.
Great.
Susan, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks.
Susan Chin is the executive director of the Design Trust for Public Space. More info at designtrust.org. This is Cityscape. I'm George Bodarkey. Finally today, a look at plans to transform an abandoned trolley terminal in New York City into the world's first underground park. It's called the Low Line, and on the phone with us now is co-founder and creator of the project, James Ramsey. James, thank you so much for taking the time.
Oh, thank you.
So give me the skinny on the Low Line.
Well, the basic idea is this. Underneath the Lower East Side, under Delancey Street, there's a giant abandoned trolley terminal. And the idea of the Low Line is that we can use this sort of next-generation advanced solar technology to irrigate natural sunlight down into that space, and in doing so, grow plants and turn it into a vibrant public space.
So natural sunlight underground in New York City.
You got it.
And how far along in the process are you?
We're very far along in the process. This is an idea that I had back in 2008. So I've been at this for a while, right? And we have had a sort of a steady march forward in terms of dealing with city and state officials, fundraising for the project itself, as well as, you know, actually developing and refining the technology that's involved in actually sort of being the centerpiece of the entire idea.
So this is brand spanking new technology. Doesn't exist anywhere else right now?
You got it.
So what does it actually look like down there?
Well, first of all, it's amazing that, you know, as you sort of approach the Williamsburg Bridge or come off it or whatever, there's hundreds of thousands of people that go over that street every day and have no idea that this amazing giant space is just hiding underneath them. And I think that's kind of amazing. And the first time I got into that space, I was completely blown away. It was like some sort of Indiana Jones moment. The space itself was built in 1905 to 1908. And so it has really a lot of the historical character of the stuff that was built in that age, right? So it's got cobblestones for the floor. It's got these big muscular steel columns and vaulted ceilings running throughout. And it was meant as a place for trolleys to come in and turn around. So because of that, it's big. So it has kind of this enormous, muscular, cavernous feeling to it. Pretty amazing stuff.
How did you stumble upon this space in the first place and come up with the idea for the Lowline?
I was sort of noodling with the idea of applying optics in this way, architecturally, to achieve, well, basically to get sunlight into places where you can't really actually otherwise get it. At the time, I happened to be also kind of buddies with an old MTA engineer who was, you know, he would tell me all these crazy stories about these lost spaces underneath New York. And there's a lot of them. You know, you can find this information pretty easily online, but, you know, there's something like 13 acres of unused space underneath Manhattan alone, right? And so New York is really kind of peppered and perforated with these hollow void spaces. And this, in my mind anyway, happens to be the sort of biggest, coolest, most impressive one. We had a couple people from our office go down and look at the original drawings that were filed for the space. And eventually, my co-founders and I were able to actually get into that space and check it out with our own two eyes. And sort of that's what really got the ball rolling.
What kinds of trees and plant life do you expect can live in these conditions with that kind of sunlight?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked. We have actually an experiment that we're calling the Lowline Lab, which is set to open in late September. So it's something that we're building right now. We have manufactured the actual real sort of high-grade optical components to actually do this for real. And we are using them to actually pipe natural sunlight into an abandoned warehouse in the Lower East Side and to use that light to experiment on horticulture to see which plants are going to like which light levels, et cetera. We have a sense, obviously, going into it of what plants like, what light level. That's common information. But in a way, this is kind of an altogether new branch, almost, of horticulture. So we do need to get our hands dirty and actually do this in real life so we know for sure what's actually going to grow and thrive down there.
So you're in the midst of that step, but how much money overall is it going to take to make this project a reality?
Well, I mean, look, there's several phases to it, and we're looking at it in two or three phases. And overall, I think this ultimately has a price tag of about $50 to $60 million, but that's for the overall project in completion with all of its phases in place.
And complete buy-in at this point from the city, everyone on board to see this go forward?
Well, every agency has endorsed us. The mayor's office itself has come out and openly endorsed the project. So, you know, I think it's very much moving forward. Now, the caveat to that, of course, is that this is something that is completely unlike any building type or any project or anything that's ever existed in the world. So it's a bit of an oddball item. And, you know, I think for the city, for the state, for us even, there's the simple matter of, okay, you know, what shape hole does this shape fit into, right? And so it's a bit of a new process for everyone trying to figure out actually how to execute such a strange and unique project.
I would imagine a big part of the equation is relying on private dollars for this.
And that is certainly true.
Do you have a target date as to when you would like to see this open?
Well, I mean, yes, I'd like to not be an old man by the time that happens. I think right now we're thinking something like 2020. It's also something that, you know, this project is also something that needs to be somewhat timed to other construction that's going on in the neighborhood. And also, you know, we need, there's a lot of research that still needs to be done, and there's a lot of fundraising that still needs to be done. So that seems like a relatively comfortable number for us to be working with.
James, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, my pleasure.
That was James Ramsey. He's co-founder and creator of The Low Line. You'll find more information about it at lowline.org. And that's it for this week's Cityscape. Past episodes of the show are available in our archives at wfuv.org/cityscape. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter for show updates and New York City tidbits. I'm George Podarchy. My thanks to producers Taylor Nolk and Claire Drake.
It's WFUV and WFUV HD, New York. Listener-supported public media from Fordham, the Jesuit University of New York. Music discovery starts here.